We are in Champions League, man.
That was my
dilly din, dilly don. Come on.
Into Sheringham and Solskjaer has won it.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
This is the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast with Gary Kernin.
Aguero.
Hello, welcome to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. My name is Gary Kareen. Joining us today is Rob McKay, head coach for University of Manchester Women's Football. He's just released a new book, Maximize Your Training Sessions, Football Practices for Ever-Changing Numbers and Spaces. Brilliant book. I've gone through it. I've read it. I loved it. And we're going to chat about the book here and Rob's philosophy towards training and session design. Brilliant insight from Rob. Highly recommend you go and get a copy of the book, available on Amazon. Tons of ideas around training principles, playing principles, all the different phases of the game as well. Pre-practice planning, review, reflection, general practices. There's so much in there. Highly recommend that you go and get yourself a copy. Love this conversation. Here is Rob. Enjoy.
Rob, thank you for joining me for the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. Excited to chat?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
The book, we're going to chat about the book. We're not going to ruin the book, obviously, for everyone because we want them to buy it and we want them to read it. But we're going to talk about some themes around session design. We had a brief chat there before we start recording. I probably should have recorded it, but never mind. Listen, the first question I have for you is a really basic, general one, but I think will lead us into the conversation, and that is, what's success at the youth level for a training session, in your opinion?
That's a really loaded question to start. for me, I think success is getting your players to have those behaviours that you want from your practice without having to coach it. So your interventions are gradually reduced throughout a session. So obviously, in a perfect world, we do something at training on a Tuesday or Thursday, whenever we train, and then we see it on match day, and we go, "Oh, like that's our fingerprints." But I think it's where we can coach and then remove that intervention and still see it. I think that for me is the success: is if you can develop players and the way they think to do the things that will help them succeed without having to have that intervention. I think that's success for me.
Rob, that's a really good answer because. I don't even know how I would answer it, but I would think quite a number of people would say, if you see something replicated in training to the match, that transfer is success. You're actually saying that it's almost the other way around. When you're actually having to do less corrections or interventions, that is the success, because that's what's been worked on and developed in the session.
100%. I mean, I work in quite a unique environment because I get players for 3 years. And I want players to grow and develop after they leave me, after they graduate. And if I don't have, if I coach them to play one way and they can only play one way, then when they leave me and they go to work, they're going to go to play for someone else, then it's going to be more of a challenge for them to adapt and assimilate. So I try to create environments where I can see what they're trying to, that we agree what we're trying to achieve, but then they can achieve that without me having to have that input. So they become more balanced footballers, without the need for my input.
Oh, this is a road to go down. Because I agree with what you say. If you're going to take responsibility for developing a player to go to the next level, then adaptability in the mindset and in the player profile is going to have to be a big, big part of that. But when you're doing that in your environment, that means that the player is going to experience less success maybe than a consistent Monday through Friday. I think some coaches would struggle with that because the monotony and the consistency of an environment is actually creates short-term success, but maybe not long-term success. Sounds like you're looking for long-term success. How do you manage that short-term?
I try to look at it as a sort of if within my session. So if I have a session that night or that evening, we have a main theme, main topic, as most coaches will do. And what it'll do is it'll start in the technical. So obviously the repetition will probably tip the realism a little bit, so we get, and then we will try and move into a into more of a game where it's that balance of repetition realism, which the England DNA really sort of espouses. Does it look like a game? Have you got that right, that right balance? And then I always like, as a coach, to have a spell of training where the players are just playing, where they're free of constraints from me. They're free of, not say so they won't have input, like they'll know I'm there watching, and I'll, they'll get encouragement, but they won't get, right, stop, do this, what was wrong with this? And what I like to do there is, if I see the success, obviously whilst I'm doing coaching the main part of the session, great. It's then, can I then make sure that success is still there when I've stepped away and I'm a passive observer? And then I'm sort of going, well, right, I'm still seeing it. Have they took it on board? Is it intrinsic? Are they doing it without thinking about it? And obviously then when you go to your match day, do you see it again? You want to reinforce your points. I'm not someone who will do one thing and move on. But obviously, if you want to sort of have a measure of success, but I think it's things I see, if I see it 4 or 5 weeks from now when we haven't necessarily worked on it for 4 or 5 weeks, then I know it's stuck and it's been successful.
Yeah, great points. I had a conversation yesterday with a coach about how difficult it is to not coach and how much of that skill as you get older and your knowledge should increase and your understanding should increase, you actually find yourself holding back a little bit more. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I like to assume that my players are sick of me after an hour. So the last half hour of training is usually theirs. But it's something I think about often is overcoaching. Is who are you there for? Are you there to prove you know it all? Are you there to prove you've got the knowledge? Are you there to make your players better? And some players respond to, obviously a lot of structure and being given the answer and can go away and then go out and execute as you ask them. Some players want that freedom to be able to experiment and make mistakes. So for me, is I try to use every practice as a, right, start, go and figure it out for yourselves. I'll stand back and observe. And then hopefully that provides me some coaching points. If it doesn't provide any coaching points, I've not challenged them enough. But then obviously it gives me the opportunity then to intervene as and when and try and keep that balance between, yes, I'm here to coach, and yes, you're here to play.
It brings us along nicely. A quote in the book that I really liked at the start, and I should say before we go into the book and delve into it, obviously without not giving too much away, I've read the book and I've emailed you, said I loved it, I really enjoyed it, and I'll go into some of the things that I did enjoy in a little bit. But the first thing was a quote that stood out to me, and I'm gonna read it out here. When I first started coaching, I spent so much time planning my session to make it perfect, ensuring every detail was correct and every player had a purpose. However, I failed to plan for the contingencies and things that I could not control. This meant that I was a very inflexible coach, which is almost what we were talking about there. So I wanted to ask, what aspects should coaches, in order to stop being or fall in the trap of being inflexible, what should they learn to ignore?
For me, in terms of what I ignore is, I ignore what it would look to the passerby. So, as we've all created our own session designs, we've all borrowed or stolen session designs. And I think a lot of the time we as coaches will go, well, X has done that, so it must be good. So there is a whole library of books out there that's got, top class coaches' names on it. And we all take that as a means of going, they've done that. When reality is, it's probably one of said 30 coaches that works for top coach. It doesn't make any, that doesn't make it any less meaningful. But it's it's the credibility. And I think for me is, I want to make sure that if my theme is correct, that's the, I've got a topic of focus for the session. My coaching points are clear, but after that, it's about being flexible and everything else. And I wouldn't, if someone came to look at my session and was like, that's too simple, I wouldn't take that as a criticism. That's great, because it means they'll understand it and we'll be able to play more football. You know, if I spend 20 minutes explaining what my session is about, then it's 15 minutes less football. In a perfect world, I would say, here's two goals, or four goals, or six goals. You know, you're attacking these, you're defending these, go and play. And then I would let them play and then use the game to bring out my coaching points. So I think for me is like the thing I've took away from it is sort of to worry less about what it might look like to others, or worry less about what it would look like on the outside, because, you know, any coach knows their players better than an outsider. You know, I know my players better than you will, Gary. You will know your players better than I will. And therefore, you will know what they will respond to. So what might look really simplistic to you might look really complicated to someone else. And often I find is, if I'm looking at a session plan and I'm going, I can't understand this. Like that for me is like, if I can't understand it, if I'm having to take 2-3 reads at it, then that's too complicated. Because if you get out there and one piece of this changes and you can't then adapt to that, then you're going to spend more time worrying about your session design than you are actually your players playing and coaching your players.
Yeah, brilliant. Alongside that then, you said that be authentic to who you are and do things your way, which is exactly what you're saying there. But it's something that, you know, you mentioned there about coaches picking up other people's sessions and all, like social media. We post more on Modern Soccer Coach for sessions and stuff like that. I still enjoy looking at that, but I look at it in a different lens now. I look at it and say, that's different. I could tweak that to do X, Y, and Z. But I do see that when you're younger, you're looking for Jose's session, or you're looking for Pep's session. Why do you think that coaches with a bit more experience, that self-awareness kind of grows and that authenticity has a greater chance of shining through?
I think it's about environment that you're exposed to. So when you start as a coach, you don't really go into an environment straight away with other like-minded people. You go into an environment where you might know a coach, you know, and you will learn off them and you rely off them. And if they're very specific or very rigid in their beliefs and their philosophies, then it doesn't expose you to others. So like my first experience with a coach was a coach who was very, very fitness based. And, you know, a 2-hour session would be 60 minutes, almost a minute of fitness without a ball. And I didn't know any better, so I thought that was how you're supposed to coach. And then couldn't understand why, when I went to other coaching environments, players didn't respond to it. And then, so when I came and kind of come away and gone, well, I'm going to go completely the opposite way. And I go, can everything be done with a ball? But then you go to another environment where it's like, well, we're used to the fitness work. And I think one of the challenges you have as a brand new coach starting out is you only know what you're exposed to. So I was exposed to a coach of a certain era who believed it was everything was done a certain way. And then I kind of broke free from that person. And when I, you know, used to talk about exposing yourself, obviously, like to different things. Obviously, one of the first books I picked up was yours, Gary. And I still to this day remember picking up your 30 session plans book and opening it up and being like, oh, well, we can't do this for this reason, or we can't do that for that reason, or this wouldn't work for that reason. And not really understanding how I could make it work for me I take what's exactly in front of me on the page and copy it. And I think that's what we have as a, especially in England, we start out with, as coaches, we kind of rely on the person that we are exposed to. And that is obviously at the start, that might be the coach that you're working with when you first start, when you do your level one, that might be the tutors. You know, you really kind of, you know, rely on what information they give you. And I don't think it's really until you're level two that you start to think about the why. Why are you doing this? And I think that's why we kind of have that sort of rigidity and that kind of one, singular mindset.
Yeah. I think of that a lot. I took a coaching course in Belfast when I first started coaching. And Packy Bonner, would you remember Packy Bonner, a goalkeeper in the 90s, Ireland?
Yes, I at USA 94.
USA 94.
Yeah.
Italian 90 is a better reflection, but okay, you're correct. So anyway, he was working for FIFA, so he came up to watch some sessions, and it was assessment day, so everyone was, a lot of young coaches, and they're all getting assessed, and people stood around him, and one of the sessions, poor coach, like, nothing was going right for the coach, and it was one of those ones, the numbers were wrong, the bibs on the wrong team, just organizationally, it was just all over the place, and everyone knew that it was a, you know, it wasn't working. So I was standing beside Paddy Bonner, and a couple of coaches, you know, kind of moved up to him and said, like, well, Paddy, what do you think here? He's got this all wrong, hasn't he? And he didn't even look. He just kept looking straight ahead, and he goes, boys, some days it works, some days it doesn't. What are you going to do? And I was one of the most impactful things that someone with that depth of knowledge and experience, and almost when you're coaching, you're thinking that you're gonna blow the socks off the session, that it's all, but as you get older, you realize that, yeah, like, some days it works and some days it doesn't. But if you just keep a level head on the improvements and the environment, you've got a way bigger chance of making an impact in the longer term.
Yeah, it's also helpful if it doesn't work, but no one notices as well. So you took me back to my UEFA B, and I was thinking about, like, my second assessment where nothing went right, but then me and my partner, we just went, we'll just coach through it. And everyone's like, oh, it's really good, that. And I'm thinking, we both look at each other and it was awful, but obviously we controlled what we can control, so we just coached. And it was like, so it doesn't matter if the session is the worst ever, if you're getting your coaching points across and people are getting better, then, you know, the impact on the play is going to be less.
That in itself is another topic on awareness and all that good stuff. Here, you haven't got pitch sizes on this. I thought that was really interesting because I get that. That question drives me absolutely mad. But I actually think you've done a really, really good thing here, because coaches, by even that, it takes you away from copy-paste. It takes you to, hey, if you've got to think dimensions, you've got to think one or two other things potentially. So I appreciate what you've done to the coaching community.
In my head, when I was writing it, it was, I think about the experiences I've had. So I've been lucky to have full pitches. I've had half pitches. I still work on a quarter of a pitch at times. I've worked on a sixth of a pitch. Right in the middle, loudest experience ever, hundreds of players around, can't hear yourself think. And I thought for me is come back to what I was exposed to. So very early on as a coach, it was like, use all the space you've got and, you know, and make it physically challenging without really considering the tactical, you know, the tactical challenge that creates. And also for me as a coach, that meant when I went from having, you know, large numbers of 18, 19, 20 plus down to 8, 9, 10, I wasn't really in a position to go, right, now we make it smaller. What does that do? So for my personal thing, I like to kind of, I'm very poor with distances. I kind of just start going and feel it out for myself. I like to put bibs down and then go, that looks about right. But for me, it's just about that. What if you don't have 40 yards by 30 yards? What if you don't have 50 yards? Then it shouldn't make the practice any less relevant to you. You shouldn't not be able to pick it up. It just means that one of the, you know, you might be touching the technical corner a lot more than necessarily the physical corner, because obviously the reaction time reduces, the decision making increases. And I think they're all good things. So if you weren't to pick up a practice and do it just because I'd said to you, you need 40 yards, you've only got 35 yards, that just seems a bit of a misnomer.
In essence, the game is about space and numbers. Your book looks like helping coaches navigate around that area of, like, okay, what if you're constrained by one or the other? When you look, and we've talked a little bit about session design, do you think an issue in coach education, not coach education, do you think an issue in coaches, in coaching, is that they're just not preparing for those things? Or do you think the issue is in the variability of showing up and you don't actually know?
I think about, I did my level one and level two almost back to back, and then I with England, and then I did my level B with Wales. So I was exposed to two different associations and the way they did things differently. And I think for me is like I think the level one was very good in terms of you are a brand new coach. Here are some kids or some players. Here are some balls. Here are some bibs. Get yourself through that hour. And then your level two was why? What is the motivation of your players and why are you doing this? And things like narrowing your topic, I thought were excellent off the course. But what I don't think either the level one or level two taught me was to go, what happens? Like the UEFA B is what if. So the big thing I took away from my B license was what if the opposition do this. But no one ever talks about what if before training even happens. So what if four players don't show up? What if you get there and the pitch is double booked and you've only got a quarter? Or what if the men's team manager needs two-thirds of a pitch instead of a half a pitch tonight? And and I don't think you're ever really given the skills to think about what happens if things go wrong. And you know, you become so focused on getting your session design right that you then go, oh, what happens if? Well, I've got 14. What happens if I have 13? What happens if I have 12? And I think we almost become so frightened of that scenario. We don't want to think about it, so therefore we don't plan for it.
Yeah, fantastic. Jake Henry was on last week from Notts County, and he said that we have to understand that everything we do as a coach has a benefit and a trade-off. And I think of that there with how I see coach education today. The organisation and periodization of exercises and session design, like I think has grown astronomically in the last 5 years. But that also has a trade-off in that you lose that imagination or that spark or that intuition or that ability to what you were doing at level one there. Here's five balls, 10 players, think on the spot. And that you might impact that session better than a, you know, 50 cones, 50 balls, two full pitches.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I told myself for the last year, well, I'm the guy who's wrote the book on last minute adjustments. So I can never complain if people drop out at the last minute. But for me, it's that, yeah, like I've had it over Christmas where I've been on a pitch waiting for players to come out of a classroom expecting 20 and had 10. And it's like, how do you adapt for such you know, such drastic differences? And I think for me, it's about having enough planning so that you're not literally walking out there going, that's 10, that's 12, make something up on the spot. So it's still meaningful, but also having that flexibility of going, do you know what, if something does happen, if there is, you know, real life does get in the way of people coming to training, then you've still got the ability then to have the skills to go, right, well, I can't do this, but can I do this instead? Or can I adjust it for this? So I think it is a balance. I don't think there's anything more stressful than rocking up to training and having absolutely no idea of how many people are coming.
Hello, coaches. We take a quick break here. Please check out Rob's book, Maximize Your Training Session, Football Practices for Ever-Changing Numbers and Spaces. Over 45 illustrated practices. Hope you're enjoying this interview. The book is a practical guide for experienced coaches and grassroots coaches as well to enhance session design and take sessions to the next level. 45 illustrated practices. I've read it. I loved it. Please check it out on Amazon. Thank you. Back to Rob.
Yeah. Well, back to that inflexibility piece then, if you go too much the other way.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the step principles for the English FA. How you found them applicable to your coaching?
Yeah, I mean, so the step principles for those who aren't aware of it are space, time, equipment, and players. So this came from my English level one. So obviously, you know, space is, you know, can change obviously session to session, but obviously can change within your session. So for me is, you know, I for one, when I think about my session and I'm planning it out, I think about what space I've got. So got a session after this where weirdly I start on a quarter of a pitch and then move out to half a pitch. So obviously then anything I plan will then start with kind of small areas, and then we'll try and build it out to bigger, more realistic games. So we might start thinking more about repetition over the realism in a smaller area to then try and make it more realistic as we build out to bigger areas. And then obviously time is really crucial because, you know, a lot of coaches, you know, we all want 2 hours, don't we? We all want 2 hours to coach. We always want an hour to get there beforehand so we can put our cones down in perfect order. But, you know, most cases you're rocking up at seven, you know, the group on you is still there at 5 to 7. They're still, you know, next goal wins at 1 minute to 7. And at 1 minute past 7, the manager's doing his debrief with his players in the middle of your area. So you're cutting into that time. So for me, it's about how much time do you have and how much time of that can you spend playing? So from the England FA, I took away 80% away. I think that's a really good number. And so I think about when I'm doing with my interventions, whether it's my session design, how quickly can I get my practice down? So I'm really fortunate at the university because my players will lead the warm-up, so it gives me like a 15-minute buffer to get the booking off before and then straight onto the pitch and be like, right, what can I get down? In what order can I get it down? So I'm hopefully have as much on the floor as I need before they're ready to start playing. So once we've actually, you know, warmed up, everything's on the pitch ready, and whatever time we've got left, it's 75 minutes, 90 minutes, is all predicated to focus on football. And then the same for equipment, because, you know, we've all seen those books where it's like 10 mannequins, you know, 6 mini goals, you know, all this equipment that, you know, we'd love to have, but obviously, you know, 99% of clubs can't afford. So again, it's about what equipment have you got. So in the book, I've been really liberal with the use of mini goals, but at some point I've called out going, cones will do. Like, I'm really fortunate. I've got access to mannequins and mini goals, but anything for me can be done with a large dome cone. Like, if you just use your imagination enough, that will fill in for a mannequin, that will fill in for a goalpost. So again, you know, coming back to the time thing is, if you've not got loads of equipment, you know, can you get stuff down quickly with the minimal amount of equipment that you need? So, you know, when I did my level 2, we had a saying about the tutors love the cone, because you'd see the tutors put out, you know, dozens and dozens of cones, because they'd have, you know, they go out 40 minutes early to set it up perfectly. You need to see, you know, this zone, the purple zone, the blue zone, the yellow zone. You're thinking, like, there's so much to take in. It's like, if you had 5 minutes to put that out, would you have the same number of cones? So when it comes to equipment, obviously, it's not just about, obviously, what equipment have you got. You don't want to plan a session, you know, which, you know, you don't want to be fighting over equipment where you're going, oh, I absolutely need the mini goals tonight, and the other coach is using them. But also, you don't want to spend, like, you know, 3/4 an hour having to put it all out to then put it back in. And then finally, players, because, you know, that's really critical, because, you know, a game looks very different when you've got 10 as to when you've got 18 or 19. If you've got 7 or 8, you know, again, is that can become very, very focused, you know. So, you know, they're the 4 main things I try to consider when I design any practice. So really try to work back from players. I always try to be very sparing with equipment personally. It's a personal choice. And then, like I say, one of the few non-negotiables I do have is about time. So making sure that it's 80% ball rolling time. And then anything I design, I want to be flexible in that space. So I might go tonight and only have a quarter of a pitch for half an hour, but I might end up going, you know what, you need that more space more than I do. So I can adjust mine into a quarter of it for all of it. So it's, you know, because you just don't know what's going to happen, or you don't know who's going to benefit what. So yeah, for me, it's just trying to work out all those different factors into your session design to make sure that, you know, you're not caught out in any way.
Yeah, ball rolling time. You said in the book, nothing kills a good session more than the coach's voice. Brilliant, brilliant line that. How do you said 80% there? Are you measuring that, or how are you?
Yes. So So my on average my sessions are 90 minutes all in, including the warm up. So I aim to make sure that we are on, like, ready for the first practice roughly 15 minutes after the session's begun, and then from there is everything is timed. So what I will do is I will obviously have the stopwatch going, and I'm a big fan of the first 3 or 4 minutes of letting players play. So I might give concurrent coaching points, but try not to like take too much of the session on. And then what I'll do is about 3 or 4 minutes in, then I'll intervene. But what I'll do is when I'm intervening, I will make sure I time how long my intervention is. So, you know, I don't want to be there doing 4 or 5 minutes. If I can do it in 60 seconds or 90 seconds, if I can get my points across in that time, then, you know, they're getting back to playing. So it keeps that ball rolling time, but also it forces me to keep my points really succinct and, you know, I'm really focused.
Yeah, the review and reflection process, again, often overlooked in a training session, similar to the preparation. How do you think coaches should formalize or could formalize that process of review and reflect?
At the university, I have my coaches. So at the start of the season, I give them a book. So and it's just a open with pitches. There's no questions on it. It's simply for them to use as they see fit. And I encourage them to sit down at each session, write down what they've done. So obviously get their practice design in there, get their coaching points on there. So they've got the ability to review at a later date, but then reflect on the session itself, because, the worst session is better than you think it is. And the best session is never quite as good as you think it is. And I think if you sit down and one of the things I've really encouraged my coaches to do is to ask each other, you know, how was your session? And be honest with, you know, what they didn't think went well, and think about how could they do that better? Or, you know, and in some cases they'll talk themselves through, oh, I wasn't happy with this. And it'd be like, well, was that in your control? And, you know, sometimes it's, I think it's really critical, because a lot of times with coaches, we can be very guilty going, the players just didn't want it tonight, or they didn't want this tonight, rather than be like, well, could I have done something different to make the session better? So for me, is I love to sit and get pen and paper and write my session plan after I do it, and then write my reflections with it. And so I've got, this is what we did, these are the coaching points from it, and this is why it went well. And then I think, what could I do better? And sometimes I dwell, like we all do as coaches, we dwell on what could we do better. But it's something across my coaching staff I've really encouraged to do, because no coaching session is ever going to be perfect. And I think that's one of the great addictions of coaching, is we want the perfect session, and every session's got the potential to be that. And every session we come away going, well, it wasn't quite. But I think if you spend your time thinking about what you did well, it'll give you that confidence moving forwards. But if you truly honest about what you think you could do better, I think that's the best way you're going to succeed for your players. Because I think if players recognize that, you know, you're someone who is, you know, will go out of the way to make those adjustments, to make things better, they tend to be more forgiving on the mistakes that you make.
Absolutely. One of the many things I enjoyed about the book, there's a nice tactical element to it. I enjoy reading about different tactical principles and ideas and beliefs around that there. It's always good, I think, to see how a coach views the game. One of your defensive principles was let the opposition play in safe areas. And I've heard this quite a few times. And this one jumped out to me, because something that I've seen in recent years is sometimes when a team's sitting in that mid block, they're almost boxing with their hands down. They're behind the ball, but they can let runners go. They can get a little bit too much space. Would you define those safe areas specifically to your system or to any area of the pitch?
I've used this terminology for different teams with different playing styles, and I think for me is, you can determine what is safe to you. It's not necessarily, oh my God, the opponent's got it there, there's no danger whatsoever. But it can be, that is a safer area and we're happy for them to have it there than somewhere else. So obviously, I think a lot of people instantly think, oh, well, if they've got it in their own penalty area, that's a safe area, we can let them have it. But obviously, if we're defending in the final third, in our own third, then we can sit there and say, well, do you know what? A wide area is a safe area and we can let them have the ball there because we can't possibly cover every area. So I think it's about the scenario, because obviously some sides will want to press aggressively and therefore, you know, and leave no area. For me, when I was writing it, I was thinking about, well, if we step out as a front line and press the penalty area when the opposition have put good, they have good field, good ball control, and they've got a good balance to their team, we're then going to leave space that they want to take off us. So I was kind of taking a sort of an American football territory vibe to it of, you know, sometimes opposition's going to have a ball, they're going to have good balance, they're going to have, you know, good players in good areas, and you've got to be able to say, recognise, actually, do you know what? You've got the ball, we can't do anything to take it off you. And anything we try to do, you'll try to exploit. So we're just going to let you have it and know that we've got 11 players behind the ball. And in this instance, you can't hurt us.
Brilliant. Yeah, because I agree. I just find it really interesting around the language, around how people communicate certain principles, because I think that is something that we don't speak a lot about. But yeah, there's areas that in every system that you're comfortable with them having it, but at the same time, then how do you communicate that there effectively? Similarly, the aspect that I found really interesting was in possession, when you're talking about the final third, which a lot of coaches, and I'm seeing this more and more. I don't know whether it's just how I'm watching the game or a bias in some form, but I'm seeing really high structure systems, which I've no problem with high structure possession systems and positional play, struggle then in the final third when the message then becomes a bit more freedom and a license to maybe move a little bit more, but to flick that on and off in a system that maybe 10 yards below that was a bit more disciplined in the position. How do you think coaches could balance that or find a balance to that?
Yeah, like I worry as a coach that I've got the tendency to overcoach, and I think the final third is somewhere where you go, you know, you think about coaches kind of mirror their teams, mirror their playing styles, don't they? So I was never a finesse player. I wasn't someone who's going to, you know, I wasn't massively creative. I started on the wing and loved running down the wing and putting the ball in. And that's what my teams do very well. And as I got older and other things grabbed my attention and I started moving further and further back, I liked 5-yard passes. I like recycling the ball. And I think what happens is you can be very guilty of going, oh, well, that's what I know, so that's what I'll tell my team to do. And in the final third, if you've got someone, you know, obviously Messi is obviously the top barometer of, if you've got someone like him, you're never going to tell him what to do, are you? But if you've got someone who's got the ability to score a goal anyway, then you're not going to stifle it. So I think for me is, I like to have a plan of areas of the field that we're going to hit. So it's like, if we're particularly fast in wide areas, so we'll go for pullback crosses so we can get speed into the penalty area, force our opponent's back line to turn. But if you've got the ability then to cut inside and curl into the top corner from 25 yards, I'm not going to prevent you doing that because it still counts as one. And I think that's, for me, that's where I try to balance the, I want you to have a plan B to fall back on or a plan A to fall back on. But if you do something in a game that's hurting the opposition and you figured that out, then you should carry on doing that. You shouldn't revert back to what I've asked you to do. And I think that's, for me, when it comes to the coaching side of it, of the training aspect, is you give them, you know, a scenario. But then if they've got the ability to break that scenario, if they've got the ability to go, actually, I found a better way, you don't try and prevent them from doing that. You encourage that. You might try and go, right, well, you've done this, so now I'm going to change the challenge to prevent that or to make that more challenging. What are you going to do now? But I think as a coach, it should be about presenting scenarios of attack for your players, and for them to work out what is the best way in any given scenario. Because, you know, you and I, we're not playing the game. They will see things differently, and they will see things faster. But if they're relying on us to go, oh, I've seen that, this is the answer, then you're never going to get anywhere, because that information isn't going to get there. One, it's reliant on you as a coach to have that answer, but two, it's reliant on you on getting that answer to your players in a good enough time. So for me, it's like, if nothing else, this is our fallback. But also, is can you, if you can score a goal a different way, then by all means score that goal.
Yeah, I find it really interesting topic. Like the Barcelona one, which you referenced Messi there, and if you go back to Barcelona and Messi, I think Henri was talking on Monday Night Football about, maybe it was 10, 12 years ago, about the three zones, and Guardiola is so structured, but then he gives you the freedom in the final third to do whatever you want. I think a lot of coaches took that as like, oh, okay, that's positional play. But then if you look at today, like I would say City are very, very efficient and as robotic and successful in the final third than they are. It doesn't seem to be off the cuff, but it's hard to, like, I don't think we'll ever know that because we're not in that environment. We don't have the luxury of that information. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned City. I mean, the last three Premier League games, they've had 71 shots on target and scored three. But I think, you know, they've had a really interesting evolution with the arrival of Haaland, because I don't think Pep's worked with a player similar to Haaland since Ibrahimovic. And I don't think he was able to get the best out of Ibrahimovic. And then last year, you could tell the first half of the season was really trying to figure out how to get the best out of Haaland. And this season, they've scored goals in different ways of Haaland. So at the start of the year, they were very much about, can we get to the far post, byline, pullback? Can Haaland peel off to the far post and score at the far post? So he did that at Sheffield United, did that at Manchester United. And then on Wednesday against Luton, they went for the up back through approach, which I hadn't seen City do before. So obviously, you know, it's probably miles easier having Kevin De Bruyne hitting your final pass. But obviously, their play was to initially hit Haaland early, which they normally don't do. They'll normally try and play Haaland at the last minute and then play off him to then play a pass back through. And I thought that was Pep obviously having an idea of how to break down specific oppositions, but leaving the players in which to figure out the best ways to do it themselves. Because if you look at each of Haaland's first four goals, they're slightly different in different areas of the field. So he's not said, right, you've got to stay central. You can pull into the half space, or, you know, you can pull into a wide area. So I think it's like, it's giving them a platform, but then trusting them to know when the best time to use it is.
Brilliant. Yeah, so interesting. Back to the book, you also have a chapter on arrival practices with ideas. Talk a little bit about that there, consistent themes that you think should be incorporated as players start getting ready before practice officially starts.
Yeah, I mean, I've used the word arrival practice. I think from the B license and Wales, they prefer technical practice because it's focused on touches and repetition as opposed to realism. In England, they like that balance throughout, of that balance of repetition and realism. So, but they use the word arrival, and I think some people use the word warm up. I like to have everything kind of linked together so that if you have, you know, when you get there, that first 15 minutes is ball rolling time, but is also linked to your overall theme of the session. But how you might overall touch how strong you might touch on that theme might be slightly less. So you might have a warm up or arrival activity or a technical practice where you are focused on a switch of play, or there's elements that link to your main practice, but you're not necessarily going full. Your coaching focus isn't quite as strong. Just as a means of not trying to overwhelm players, or not trying to be like, right, here, play 15 minutes. This 15 minutes or 20 minutes is still relevant. You'll be better for it. You know, you're getting better as you're playing it. It'll link to what we're about to do, but it's not like you've got to focus solely on this one focus for 15 minutes and then again for another 20, 25 minutes. For me, it's just about getting people moving, getting people in that headspace to think, I'm setting you a challenge. There are points to be coached, but and it does link to what we're about to do, but it might not be so obvious. So you might start with 15 minutes of bib tag or captain a flag where there's no ball involved. But that off the ball movement is really critical to what you're doing in your main practice, because you're trying to encourage people to think about third man runs or attack where the space is. And although you're doing it without a ball, that will still be part of your overall practice when you come to your main theme.
Definitely the biggest piece of the book I enjoyed was the fact that you talk about your journey, your coaching journey in it. And I emailed this day afterwards. I said, it's very, very difficult when you're writing a coaching book to kind of put your own personal twist on it. But I felt as if I knew you when I was reading the book. And I enjoyed that there. I enjoyed, like, all right, you're going through this process and going through that there. Was that something that, or even what's the biggest area of growth over the last 10 years as you've gone through your experiences and your coaching degree?
I think my biggest area of growth is about keeping my mind open, about making sure that, there are things I've done and I've had success, but not to rely and go, that's the way I've always done it, so that's the way I'll always do it. And it's to listen to my players, to coaches, to listen to everyone, really, because you can have a moment where you're in the ground and you can hear one person saying something from the stand, and I think it's just about listening to the information that's available and using that in the right way. Sometimes people are going to say stuff out of frustration, and you've got to recognize whether that's oh, you're saying that because they're frustrated, or whether they're saying that to help you. But I think it's really, really important to listen to all the information that you've got. Ask questions of your players, listen to what they have to say. Ask questions of, of coaches who you don't necessarily know. Recently, I met a coach who just started out, and they were like, and they were sort of bigging me up, and I was like dead embarrassing, and I was like, I'm only as good as the person I've listened to, or the people I'm only as good as, like, and it's for that person is that they're actually a very good coach, because they took on so much information from different people. They've always filled with ideas and the ability to listen and ask. And I was like, I'll be coming to you being like, what an amazing coach you are, because I can see what they're trying to do early doors. So I think for me, it's just about making sure, like, I don't rest on what I've done, not which, I can say it's not very much, but I would like to go, I've had success, but I know the reason for success is this, but it doesn't mean the reasons for my success in the future will be because of this. It might be something completely different. And it's just to make sure that whatever I do is I go into an environment and I try to figure out what the best thing is for the players that I'm coaching, and not be like, I've always done it this way, so I'm always going to do it this way. But I as a coach will go, actually, you as players actually need something maybe more challenging, or actually you might need more of an arm around your shoulder, or actually we need to get more success into you earlier because you're less confident. We need to be, we can't allow two or three sessions to arrive before you start to see success. You kind of need to do it straight away because you need to get on board, or I need that credibility. So I think for me, it's just about making sure, like, the environment suits my players, and it's adaptable to what their needs are.
Yeah, I think you absolutely nail it. That piece of the environment change. I don't think you go away from reading the book thinking, this will transfer every exercise to playing like City or Barcelona. I think you go away in the book and think, all right, this is a coach's experiences and insight with the understanding and the knowledge. But I think a constant theme is adapt. And that's something that I really, really enjoy. I'll talk about a couple of exercises here just as we finish up. When did you start thinking about the book? When did that process start for you?
It was about 18 months ago. I was after training one evening, and both my coaches, my second and third team coaches, both walked off the pitch and went, I wanted to do this, but I didn't have the right numbers. And I was trying to explain to them, like, on a short walk of, like, well, you need to be adaptable to the numbers. Like, that's the environment you're in. We're not professional football coaches. We don't work with professional players. We work with people who are good at football, but their priority is to come and get an education. So, we have to be adaptable to that. So it's, if you're designing session 14 and 13 show up and you can't do your session with 13, then you, one, you're not preparing yourself for the long haul of being a coach outside the professional game. But B, you're not going to get the best out of your session. You're always going to be frustrated with yourself because, you know, you're relying so much on a variable that can change quite dramatically and with very little notice. So I wanted to, for my coaches, I wanted to put something together that was about how they can coach the themes they want to coach within the environment of what we've got. So the constraints of what we are as a university of, we are quite a big university with lots of players, but not a single sports degree. We have no scholarships. Everyone comes to University of Manchester to get an education and they choose football and they choose to play football. And we've been blessed with some really talented players, but you know, our culture is to marry that balance of sport and excellence with developing the person, but also prioritising education. So, you know, I would never expect any of my coaches to be like, yeah, I know you've got an assignment due, a deadline, you've got to come to training because I've got this practice. It would be to work within the parameters of understanding that that person's there to get their university degree. So I wanted to put something together that wasn't me telling them, wasn't me going, this is how you do it. I wanted to put something together that was like a guide for them to say, listen, this is how I've adapted. This is how I have successfully delivered practices on these themes. And, you know, I wanted to have, to give them sort of, you know, half a dozen practices for each area of the field, both in and out of possession, and then be able to have the ability to still go away and be like, you can still make it your own. Like if I'm just giving you six practices, your mind switches off and therefore the player's mind switches off. So I started writing and I thought it'd be like a quick task of just writing a few practices. And then I wanted to provide it with some context. So that's where the, you know, this all links to how we play. And then I wanted to build out, you know, like what they need to think about or what our coach should think about, the considerations before they come to training. And it just sort of snowballed into this book. And I started seeking feedback from other coaches and someone just went, have you tried publishing it? And I was like, who's going to want to read a book by me? And I spoke to Benny and Kearney and they were like, you know, what's the reason this book should exist? And I said to him, I said, you know, for me, it's about that ability to improvise and adapt. And for coaches who have planned for one thing to then be able to, you know, still operate if something happens. And, you know, I sent them a couple of chapters and they liked it. And, you know, it was, as you know, Gary, you've written a few books. It's the hardest thing ever to write a book. So it took a lot longer than I thought it would. I think one of the hardest things about writing a book is when you're coaching at the same time, you want to include so much. But at the same time, you're so focused on your coaching, you feel like you're neglecting the book. So it was really just about providing a tool for my university coaches in which I could provide them with information, but not be overbearing with it, not to be like, I want you to coach the Rob McKay way. I wanted there's something to be like, as much as you want to progress and develop as coaches, here is a book that will help you do that.
Yeah. God, I mean, the process is difficult. James does a brilliant job. Benny and Kearney's, he does a really good job of supporting the writer as well. And then when you give it to him and you finalize it, then you get it all done, you say, never again. But then I think the hardest part of writing a book is about a month later, you realize, or maybe 6 months later, you realize your head's in a different space. You realize your ideas have kicked on. So you're thinking, well, I need to either update this, which I'm not going to do. I won't go down that rabbit hole, or write another one. So what's the next? Are you going through that phase at the minute?
Yeah, I am. So originally, this was the season I was going to admit. So spoiler alert, the book is focused around 4-3-3 in the practice design and the way with, and sort of the tactical discussion is about a 4-3-3. But this was the year I was going to adapt to a box midfield. I thought the players I would have at university would be better suited to a 3-4-2-1. Spent my summer really researching how to do it. It makes it dead easy that obviously Arsenal have done it, you know, a boxing field under Arteta, and Pep did one last season, moving Johnny Stones into midfield. You know, and I was like, oh, I felt it would benefit my players. So I started doing my game model from scratch as a 3-4-2-1. And I was like, right, did that. And then I started putting together the practice design and got to university, got to October, got to trials, and then didn't have the players for it anymore because I had two graduate, I had two go professional, which is very selfish of them. I mean, incredible for someone, two players to earn a living in the game, but like incredibly selfish.
What club did they go to?
So Jasmine McQuaid has joined Newcastle United, so she's really excelling there. And Mia Lawrence Kay is at Sunderland. So yeah, they've both gone full time with them, which is a massive testament to them. I'd love to take some credit out of both of them, but it's both their own doing. And then, as you know, I had some people not come back, which was new for us. So I kind of didn't have the players then to do it, but I was like, well, I've started writing it. I've got the diagrams for what I want it to look like, and I've got the session designs, and I've got this gap in my time because obviously I was writing the book and I was spending all my spare time writing the book. And it's like, well, it wouldn't be that much now to start writing the second book on 3-4-2-1 because not very many people have written a book about that formation. Yep. No. So it's in the works, but it's whether or not I want it to see the light of day. So,
you know, it's funny you say that you didn't have the players because it is such a specific. I looked at it about 6 months ago for about a month, did a study on it. And my word, like, it is specific to a certain profile of player. But then you're also looking at it and thinking, there's so many cool adaptions to this system that I can see exactly why that got the...
Probably. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm really fortunate being in Manchester, get to see a lot of Pep, and the way they was able to create those overloads in central areas last year to break down a lot of low blocks, and you're like, oh my god, like it felt revolutionary. And I'd done a box midfield a number of years ago, and it was about the overloads in central areas for me because a lot of sides. You know, a lot of the sides we play are 4-3-3. One side of players are 3-4-3. And, you know, so you've seen a lot of the same thing. Everyone knows what everyone else is going to do. And it was, you know, it wasn't... So it was very... It was very similar and very samey. And I just thought, if I throw something very different at the opposition, then we're always going to have the ability to adapt into an overload centrally, an overload in wide areas. We can put an extra player wherever we wanted to. And I thought it was just something that was really exciting. And, you know, obviously it's very specific formation, but the players I had, I was like, oh, I think they'll really thrive on it because when I wrote it, with specific, you know, left side centre mid will be this or left side holding midfield will be this. When I wrote the specifics for the role, I had each of my players in mind for it. And I just felt it would really suit us, but sadly it didn't come to pass. But hopefully in book form one day.
Get that out. Yeah, get that out. It'll definitely be all over that there. What a brilliant insight. The book available US and UK?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon and on both UK and the US. And it's also available at Barnes & Noble on their website as well for you fucking Americans.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, here, I highly recommend... people pick it up, and I really, really appreciate you let me have a read of it and having a chat about it and getting your insight around it. Like I said, it's a very hard skill to write a book and not make it A goes to B, B goes to C, blah blah blah. You've done a brilliant job writing this book, so I encourage everyone to pick up a copy, and maybe we get you on again for the follow up.
Thank you. It's very, very nice of you to say. So obviously, with someone who's written such incredible books as yourself, and yeah, I'm glad that's what's come out of the book, because ultimately, if I can help coaches create themselves new ideas, then obviously, you know, coaching will be a better place, and the game will be a better place for it. But yeah, I really appreciate your kind words.
Oh, brilliant. No problem. You also, and I want to stress this here, like another. Maybe a trap or something just a natural of a do this is that, you know, puts the coach on a pedestal. And I thought, or I believe today strongly that like coaches, it's got to be information sharing. It's got to be people sharing experiences rather than sharing knowledge. And you do both in that there. So well done, Rob. Get the next one written.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Soccer Coach Podcast. For more coaching topics, sessions, and resources, head on over to Coach Kernin on Facebook or visit the website at www.modernsoccercoach.com.